This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 15th day of February 2011. And once again, I am joined on the line by regular CorbettReport.com guest, Dr. Tim Ball. Dr. Tim Ball is, of course, an expert on climate science and has been teaching at the University of Winnipeg for many years. He's now retired and living in Victoria. And Dr. Tim Ball, it is excellent to have you back on the program today. Thank you for joining us again.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, James. I really appreciate it, trying to get the other side of the story out to everybody.
Absolutely, and it's the other side of the story that is slowly starting to get more attention, and the tide is absolutely and definitely and tangibly turning, and it has been for a few years now, so that is good to see, but of course it's still an uphill battle against the many well-funded forces that are arrayed against us in this fight for scientific truth. And on that note, I guess today I wanted to start exploring some of the scientific reasons behind anthropogenic global warming climate scares and what the science really indicates. So I wanted to talk today specifically about the idea of the sun and how the sun really is the driver of climate. And it's something that you've brought up several times before on the podcast, but I wanted to get into some of the scientific details. But before we do that, perhaps you can address once again for the audience how even the word climate itself deals quite directly with the concept of the sun.
Well, yes, the word climate comes from the from a Greek word, klimat, which means angle. And what the Greeks were talking about and understood very well 2,000 years ago was that the angle of the sun creates the seasons and determines the general pattern of weather and climate around the globe. And they divided the world up into three climate zones, the frigid, the temperate, and the hot. And, of course, they understood that the seasons were driven by the changing angle of the sun. The interesting thing is, of course, that the Greeks' knowledge essentially disappeared, as did all knowledge during the Dark Ages, as they're called. And it wasn't until the Renaissance, the rebirth of Greek views of the world and ideas and so on, that people started to look at the weather and climate again. But that's well into the 19th century. And so once you understand that the changing angles of the sun and the amount of heat energy that reaches the Earth from the sun, those two variabilities are the major drivers of the seasons and the global temperature over time. And of course, one of the things that's interesting, James, is that one of the driving forces for your introduction, where you said that the tide is changing, and I agree with you. I'm talking to two groups this last week, about 300 people each, and there was no anger, no outbursts, no yells. It was, in fact, the questions were very, very well phrased. People are really starting to think. The ironic part about it is that it isn't really much to do with any of the work that I've done. People sort of said, "Oh well, yeah, he's a renegade, and we admire him for being so stubborn." But what has really changed things is that since 2000. The sun has gone into a decline, and we'll talk about the mechanisms of this, and that has caused these very cold temperatures and cold seasons around the world. That, of course, is what has made people sit up and think. And my opening comment to both groups was a joke that global warming is another undelivered government promise. And so That's had the greatest impact on people, is this cold weather. And then, of course, the responses to it. Because if you are trying to defend the indefensible and continue to do so, you're forced into making ridiculous statements that simply makes people even more suspicious. So we had, for example, Al Gore's comment that the science is settled. Well, even people that don't understand science, and a lot of the media looked up and said, "Hang on a minute, science is never settled." And that single statement by Gore was a pivotal point. The latest one, of course, is the statement by supposedly reputable scientists saying that the current cold weather is due to warming. Well, that's so illogical that even people that don't understand anything about the science are saying, hang on a minute, now this is starting to sound ridiculous. And so these are the things that are turning the tide. And as I said, it's ironic that it is a shift in the sun. Now, it's no surprise to me or any of the so-called skeptics, because you've only got to study and understand climate in a cursory way to realize that the sun and its energy is by far the driving force. And when you know and understand the solar cycles and relate them to the global temperature, it just is so obvious that you really can't overlook it.
Absolutely, now, yes. Well, yeah. I think you're right to break it down into those two different forms of solar influence over climate. You mentioned the angle of the sun and also the intensity of the sun. So breaking it into those two areas, the first one being the angle of the sun, people obviously understand the seasons and how the sun is in different parts of the sky during the seasons, but perhaps people don't really understand the larger cycles that are going on with the orbit of the Earth around the sun and how that changes over time.
Well, and this is the thing that's so fascinating about studying anything in the natural world, because on the surface it seems simple, or people simply, because they live in it every day, they take it for granted. But when you challenge them with a question that appears so simple, and they realize they don't understand at all. For example, why is the sky blue? There's very few people that can answer that question. And if you go to other planets, the sky is slightly pink. And how does that happen? So even simple questions like that, which you go out and say, well, the sky is blue. That's the way it is. And, well, why is that? What's causing that? And, of course, it's a function of the sunlight hitting particles in the atmosphere and scattering them in a process called Rayleigh scattering. But even that, you see, gets quite complicated very quickly. And it's that part of the problem that these people have been able to fool the world about the climate issue. That people think they understand things and they see things and they just take them for granted. And but the actual answers and explanations get pretty complicated pretty quickly. And so when you mention the angle of the sun, that's part of three major mechanisms that is still being taught incorrectly in some parts of the world, some school systems, and it is related to three motions of the sun, or the sun's relationship to the Earth. And these are the orbit of the Earth around the sun. And just to illustrate the problem, a few years ago in Europe, they did a survey and they found that I believe the figure was 17% of the population still believe that the sun goes around the Earth, not the other way around. And there's the difficulty. Even if you, in other words, they still haven't accepted the Copernican idea that the Earth orbits the sun, and the reason is because it's very difficult to prove that the Earth goes around the sun. And even though Copernicus proclaimed it 400 years ago or more, it wasn't proved until late into the 19th century. And of course, you see, it's like we're talking with the blue sky. All of the evidence suggests otherwise. You get up in the morning and you go out and the sun's over here, and then during the day it moves across the sky. You say, well, I'm standing here. I haven't moved. And then you say, well, but the Earth is rotating around the sun and it's spinning around at a tremendous rate, 1,000 miles an hour. Well, hang on a minute. That I'm not moving. What are you telling me? So it's understandable that people are easily fooled or don't understand or don't believe. And so that's where the problems begin. And the motions of the Sun-Earth relationships are generally taught and were up until 1990 almost. I remember going to conferences where the idea that changes in the Sun-Earth relationship were simply rejected at scientific conferences. And I remember going to a conference, and it was 1989 specifically, I remember, in Ottawa. And a fellow got up and he quoted the Milankovitch effect. And we'll talk about that. But he quoted the Milankovitch effect, and nobody challenged it. And I realized at that point that what Milankovitch had been working on since 1930, and which other people had been working on, people like Kroll, a Scottish scientist, was working on 150 years ago, that the orbit of the Earth around the Sun changes from almost circular, as it is now, to an extreme ellipse, as it was 22,000 years ago. But we're still teaching that it's a virtually unchanging ellipse. But we've known, as I said, scientifically, that that's wrong for 150 years. Now, that needs some explanation, and we'll get to that in a minute. So you've got the orbit of the Earth changing, and it's referred to scientifically as the orbital eccentricity. It's caused primarily by the gravitational pull of the planet Jupiter. Now, Jupiter is such a massive planet with such an influence in terms of gravity on the Earth that it distorts the orbit of the Earth, and it makes it change from this almost circular to extreme ellipse. And it goes from almost circular to extreme ellipse and back again, in other words, the complete cycle, in about 90 to 95,000 years. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but what it means is that every single year, the orbit of the Earth around the Sun is slightly different. The distance of the Earth from the Sun is slightly different. And, of course, the distance you are from the fire determines the amount of heat energy that you're going to get from that fire. So that orbital change alone becomes a very significant factor. And it's reasonably certain that this changing orbit explains the approximately 100,000-year ice age cycles that occur. And we can talk about that a bit later on. Now, the other thing is that the textbooks still, for the most part, teach that the tilt of the Earth is 23.5 degrees. Now, the tilt, that 23.5 degree angle is, if you think about the Earth going around the Sun, that forms a plane, a surface. The tilt is to that plane. And so, again, it's a very fancy title or name for it. It's called the obliquity of the ecliptic. And it's given out as 23.5 degrees. It isn't actually. It's about 23 degrees, 36 minutes, and so many seconds. But that tilt is constantly changing. And now I'm not talking about the wobble. The wobble is something different again. But the tilt is changing, and it changes from a minimum of 21.8 to a maximum of 24.4 degrees. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, as the tilt of the Earth changes, of course, that's what creates the seasons. And it also is what creates those lines on the Earth that everybody's familiar with, the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn, and the Arctic Circle and the Antarctic Circle. So, for example, the sun's rays at the equinox, the sun's rays are directly over the equator, vertical to the equator, at noon on the equinox. So that's twice a year. But as the tilt and the orbit of the Earth changes, the latitude at which the sun's rays are vertical moves north to the Tropic of Cancer and then south to the Tropic of Capricorn. So the amount of heat energy going into each of the hemispheres changes, and that, of course, creates the seasons. Now, the Arctic Circle and the Antarctic Circle are the lines at which the sun's rays touch the Earth tangentially. And, of course, towards the pole from those lines, you get the seasons are 6 months in length, of 6 hours, where you've got 24 hours of light and 24 hours a day in the extreme seasons. And so that tilt then becomes enormously important in the distribution of the heat energy around the Earth. And the angle of the sun striking a surface, which the Greeks were familiar with their word klimat, is called the angle of incidence. And of course, the more vertical and more direct the rays hit the surface, the more heat is imparted to that surface. Now, people are familiar with that because they've all played with magnifying glasses. And they know that if you hold the magnifying glass at exact right angles to the sun's rays, you can concentrate the heat of the sun to set things on fire. But if the angle of the magnifying glass is anything but at right angles to the sun's rays, the heat is dissipated. And that's exactly the same idea. So as the angle of the incidence of the sun on the Earth's surface changes, the amount of heat imparted to the surface changes, and that creates temperature change. So those are two major changes in the sun's orbit and tilt that have incredible impact upon the amount of heat energy and therefore the varying temperature of the sun. Now, people are familiar with it, as I said, on a seasonal basis. What they're not familiar with is that that is constantly changing. And, of course, over long times, or even relatively short times, that affects the climate of the Earth and causes the temperature of the Earth to rise and fall in pretty regular cycles. Now, there is a third part of these sun-Earth relationships, and it's called the precession of the equinox. And it's the most complicated of them. But the best way to think about it is not in terms of what's happening, but in terms of the dates on which things happen. So, for example, right now, we say that the equinox that I mentioned, or the summer solstice, that's a term everybody's familiar with. Even the people that built Stonehenge were familiar with the summer solstice and the winter solstice. And these are the points on the horizon at which the sun rises and sets. And of course, that changes over time. Now, the precession of the equinox is changing all of the time. So the dates, for example, of midsummer or midwinter, right now, the shortest day of the year, December 21st, 22nd, the longest day of the year, July the 4th and 5th, those are the current situations. But if you go forward 10,000 years, they're exactly the opposite. Now, we know this because people create, over the centuries, have created calendars. We have a calendar. The calendar, of course, is a fixed thing, but because of these changes in sun-Earth relationship, the calendar gets out of phase with what is actually happening, and people notice this. And so every once in a while, we have to change the calendar to catch up with these changes that are going on in nature. And so, for example, the Egyptians had a calendar of 12 months of 30 days in each month. And then they realized that there was 6 days missing at the end. So they simply had 6 days of holidays. And after 400 years, their calendar was so out of phase with their growing season and what was going on, they simply abandoned the calendar and they just said, okay, the year begins when the Nile floods. And the Nile floods every time the dog star Sirius appears on the horizon. And so they changed their calendar to get away from this problem. And it's an illustration of that we intuitively know that nature is changing all the time, but we don't teach that. And we certainly don't set up our calendars to accommodate that. Now, they made a major change in 1782 when they switched from the old calendar to the new calendar, went from the Julian calendar to the new Gregorian calendar. And the British government, many governments throughout the world, simply decreed they were going to make the jump the calendar forward by 11 days at that time. So they simply added 11 days to the year, and there were riots. I mean, people were outraged. They thought, a lot of them thought the government had shortened their lives by 11 days because suddenly there was a year that was 11 days shorter. The accountants, the bookkeeping, it was just chaotic, but they had to do it in order to keep the calendar up with what was going on. Now, some people didn't change. And you see that, for example, in Eastern Europe and the Ukrainians, they still operate on the old Julian calendar. And, of course, they don't have Christmas Day until, I believe, it's January the 12th. And so you can see these changes and their impact on history and us trying to keep up with nature. Now, this raises, James, a very important point, because when I talk about the Egyptians or I talk about the Ukrainians, our view of the world is set by society and taught in our school systems. And the Western scientific view of the world, and I think we might have talked about this in a previous program, is that change is extremely gradual. In other words, virtually doesn't occur over long periods of time. And this is called uniformitarianism. And I like to point out that if it sounds like a religion, it's because it basically is. It's the religious basis of Western science up until the middle of the 20th century, when suddenly people said, well, hang on a minute, there are chaotic events, and the chaos theory came into being. But the idea that there's very, very gradual change over long periods of time meant that these ideas of changing orbit and changing tilt were simply unacceptable. Now, James Croll, I mentioned, the Scottish scientist, who was looking at the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, he was just considered a crackpot. He published articles, but it was just purely of academic interest. And, of course, you notice that what that term, you say, well, it's something of it's a purely academic, means it's irrelevant to the real world. And so Cole's work was not considered of great importance except by a few scientists. Now, other people picked up on his work, and it progressed, and they started to put together the orbit change, the tilt change, and the precession change. But the person that brought it all together was a gentleman by the name of Milutin Milankovic. He was a Serbian mathematician, and I think it's enormously interesting that he was related by marriage to another very important person, but was also a good friend of a third. And all of these men had huge impact upon modern science and how we see the world, yet hardly any of them are known. Now, one of them was, of course, Alfred Wegener, who was a geologist, and Wegener was the first person to propose the idea of continental drift. That is, that the continents are moving around the Earth, splitting apart, bumping together, and where all the earthquakes occur. And, of course, that continental drift theory, which only came into acceptance while I was teaching, that's how recent it is. Yet Wegener proposed it in 1912 in part of his discussions with Milankovic. And so you can see how very recent our understanding of major global mechanisms are. And of course, the continental drift theory was considered absolutely insane. How could these massive continents be moving? But anyway, he was working with Milankovitch. The third person produced a climate classification system, and his name was Vladimir Köppen. Now, Köppen is K-O-E-P-P-E-N. He was a climatologist, a mathematician, but he was working on trying to identify and classify the different climate patterns around the world. And of course, his work is still being used today because he was working on patterns of precipitation and so on. And his work is still the basis of what is called climate classification. And so these three men at the beginning of the 20th century were absolutely pivotal in our understanding of the world today. And so Milankovitch, of course, was publishing, putting out his ideas. And when they first came out in the 1950s, they were generally accepted. People said, oh yeah, this is very exciting. This is new material. Now, the reason for that, of course, was that we're post-war. Milankovitch had to sit on his information through the war, and it was a world that was open to new ideas, was looking for a different world. And so Milankovitch published his stuff, and as I said, it got general acceptance, but then it got attacked. And one of the things that undermined it was that the new method of dating things was radiocarbon dating came in. Now, this is part of the new idea of nuclear and radiation and so on. And what happened was that Milankovitch had created a temperature curve for the Earth going back over 400,000 years. And the calculations to do that with before computers is absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, he deserves all kinds of accolades just for the sheer effort of the work that he put into it. But the radiocarbon dating came out. Milankovitch had said that there was ice in parts of Alaska because there was an ice age going on at a certain time. They got some tree samples from Alaska and radiocarbon dated them and showed that the trees were growing at the time Milankovitch said there was ice. Well, of course, obviously Milankovitch is wrong and his whole theory collapsed. It turned out that the radiocarbon dating was wrong because, and this will lead us into another part of this discussion, the radiocarbon dating assumes that the energy from the sun is coming in, the carbon 12 is absorbed by living things and then converts to carbon 14 after the living thing dies. They assumed all of that was occurring at a constant rate, the energy from the sun and the rate of conversion to carbon 14. Well, of course, we now know that the energy from the sun is not constant. And once they made that adjustment, it turned out Milankovitch was correct and the radiocarbon dating was wrong. Milankovitch, meanwhile, was completely rejected, and his son wrote a marvelous essay as a preface to a book or two-volume set commemorating Milankovitch and his work. And his son argued that he died heartbroken, literally heartbroken, because his life's work had been completely rejected. And, of course, since then, as I said at the beginning, in 1989 was the first time that I heard Milankovitch referenced as an explanation for a temperature change in a record, and it wasn't immediately jumped on and rejected. So that whole Milankovitch effect, as it is now called, is still not known by most people. Now, of course, In the computer models, they can put this in, but in the IPCC models, it's considered so insignificant that it's downplayed completely. But as I said, what you got is every single year, the tilt is changing. Every single year, the orbit is changing. Every single year, the precession of the equinox is changing. And when you add those up, and you plot them out over a million years of record, as has been done, it causes 100 watts per square meter change in the amount of energy received at the surface of the Earth. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, the significance is that the IPCC claim that humans, with their CO2, are causing approximately a 1.5 watts per square meter of change in the energy in the Earth's forcing, that is, that's causing the climate to change. So the Milankovitch against the 1.5 of the human CO2 that they're claiming, it just swamps it. But as I said, it's not considered significant. So that's one of the major, major factors the public know virtually nothing about, that the students are just beginning to appear in the textbooks, and that people need to become aware of.
Absolutely. Absolutely fascinating, and definitely a part that is almost never discussed when people are discussing climate cycles. So can you put it into perspective for people where we are in terms of the orbit and the precessions and all of that at the moment, and which way we're heading? I mean, obviously there must be grand cycles of ice ages and thaws. So where are we right now?
Yeah, well, of course, the as usual, I'll start with a context for it. In 1990, there was a climate conference in Warsaw, which was very interesting because, of course, the Cold War was at its height at that time. And the conference split right down the middle, and I'll use the term deliberately. It was split ideologically, in that the Soviets, as they were then, and the Eastern world, and the Chinese, were arguing that climate is simply a combination of cycles, a myriad of cycles, all functioning on fairly regular intervals in themselves, but when you add them together, create quite a net variability in the amount of energy reaching the Earth. The Western world, including particularly led by the U.S., was chaos theory was at full tilt, and they were arguing that the weather systems are chaotic and therefore unpredictable. And I used to tease them, say, you got to hope that's right. It might explain why your weather forecasts are so wrong. And the world looked at that conference and assumed that the split was a ideological split, that it was a Cold War split between the East and the West. But it wasn't. It was a very genuine scientific split around what are the driving mechanisms and the patterns of climate change. And so, of course, the Milankovitch cycles, and you know, in my previous comment, I mentioned 1989, where Milankovitch starting to come back in. And so, of course, the conference in 1990 falls right into the middle of that. Now, the Soviets, or the Russians, and the Chinese, for that matter, and I've worked with both climatologists from both nations, they've long believed in these cycles. For example, in the stock market, there's actually a journal published called Cycles, and many economists believe in these cycles and use them to try and plot the market. And one of the most famous cycles is the Kondratiev cycle, or K cycle as it's called, which the Russian came up with over 100 years ago, and it relates to precipitation patterns in the middle latitudes, which determine the amount of grain produced, which of course affects food supply and which affects the economy. And so the Russians and other nations have been dealing with these cycle issues, but as I said, in the West, they were rejected up until well into the 1990s. And So right now, back to your question, the Earth's orbit is very close to circular, It is at a minimum of ellipticity, and it's moving back towards increased ellipticity. And I got to be honest with you, right off the top of my head, I've forgotten which way the tilt is going, but it's very easy to look it up. Wikipedia will give a quick answer to which way the tilt is going. And of course, the precession of the equinoxes is continuing, so that the date of Midsummer Day is shifting. So right now it's July 4th, and it's moving back towards December 21st. And so those patterns are continuing. It's easy now to work it out, because it's simply regular changes that can be plugged into a computer model, and it can be forecast. And as I said, all the listener has to do is look up the Milankovitch effect on Google and the Wikipedia, and they will see it explained in which direction we're going. Generally, it explains the major pattern of temperature, and the major pattern is that we go from a glacial period, as we were. A peaked about 22,000 years ago. The world's been warming for the last 18,000 years approximately, with variability in between, of course. And we're at an interglacial right now, that is a peak warm period. And people should be grateful for that, by the way, because you go and look at what the world was like just 20,000 years ago. I mean, there'd be virtually no people on the planet at all, and agriculture, as we know it, wouldn't exist. But the only debate now is how long this current interglacial will last, or whether it's even peaked. Now, some people think it's peaked, and that we're on the long slide back down to another glacial period. And people can see the pattern of that, of glacials and interglacials, if they look at the ice core record from Antarctica. And what you see is a gradual decline of temperature down to the ice age, and then a sudden peak up to the interglacial. And of course, we've had this sudden peak up to an interglacial over the last 18,000 years. And It's what I define as a sawtooth pattern. So you've got a steep side to the sawtooth, and then a gradual decline on the other side. And as I said, we're right at the peak of the sawtooth right now. And there's no doubt that these major cycles, the Milankovitch cycles, will lead us back to another ice age. We should be extremely grateful that we're in an interglacial, and the long-term condition of the Earth is cold. And when you look at the history of the Earth over 600 million years, it's more often cold than warm. And so we're lucky to be living when we're living.
We certainly are, and I think that's a point that people fail to appreciate. Again, a lot of these are very simple points, and when we stop to actually think about them, they make perfect sense, but we very seldom do stop to think about them. So I think that covers the idea of how the angle of the sun or the precession of the equinoxes and things like that, how that affects the temperature, unless you have anything to add on that before we move on to the sun itself.
No, I think that just a sort of summary, generally you can say that it explains about 75% of long-term temperature change. And of course that the temperature is simply a manifestation of changing energy. And that energy, of course, does other things such as evaporation and precipitation and so on. And of course that is part of the problem that we have, James, is that the focus is solely on temperature, when or almost exclusively on temperature, when we really, for our plants and animals, what the precipitation is going to do is probably more important in the short and medium term. But there are other changes in the sun that we need to discuss.
All right, well, go ahead. What's on the table?
Well, what's on the table is that a significant turning point in the cosmology, that is the total awareness of our universe and cosmos, was the invention of the telescope. And of course, when Galileo turned his telescope on the sun, well, first on the moon and saw the imperfections on the moon, but then saw the sunspots. And of course, this was not just a blemish on the face of the sun, but it was simply something that couldn't happen or shouldn't happen in the prevailing Western science. And I'll stress that again, that is the Greek and Roman and church view of this, of the world, simply couldn't happen. That beyond the orbit of the moon, the universe was in perfect motion and in perfect harmony and perfect condition, that these spots simply shouldn't occur. And of course, then he also saw the moons of Venus, and it's, so suddenly here's another planet with moons going around it, and that wasn't supposed to happen. And so it was just further confirmation of the Copernican idea that challenged the geocentric, that is the Earth at the center, and put the sun at the center, heliocentric. And one of the things that people don't realize is the church was angry at Galileo, put him under house arrest, not because he necessarily put the sun at the center and not the earth. That bothered them, but it wasn't a big issue. The real issue was that he said that the universe was infinite. And of course, they came back and said, well, if the universe is infinite, there is no place for heaven, because heaven was supposed to exist beyond the universe. And Galileo, of course, or Copernicus, I should say, had said the universe is infinite. Now, Copernicus, as a canon of the church, and that means he was a church lawyer, if you want, knew how he could get into trouble with a lot of what he was saying. So he didn't approve publication of what he was saying till he was on his deathbed. But even before that, a lot of his ideas had got out because he was disseminating them to other scientists. And the church challenged this. This was the big issue. And Copernicus then became, as I said, the first political scientist in history, because he said, well, I misspoke. It isn't infinite. It's an immeasurable distance. And so that then left space for heaven. But of course, by the time you get to Galileo, Galileo is finding evidence that challenges the other major precept, and that is that beyond the moon, the universe is perfect, and that the spots on the sun and the moons around Venus simply shouldn't be there. And the sunspots then, and Galileo was the first person to record them and draw them, became of great interest to people and to science. And they started counting them. And a fellow by the name of Wolf created what is called the Wolf Index. And the Wolf Index not only recognized that the total number of sunspots changes, but the sunspots form in groups, that they appear first at the equator, and then they migrate out from the equator towards the poles, then disappear around 40 degrees of solar latitude. And there was not only a change in the total number of sunspots, but a change in the number in each group and in the number of groups. So he created, as I said, what's known as the Wolf Index, which gives a very good measure of the variability in the number of sunspots. Now, we've known, sorry, I have to have a drink here. We've known, James, for a long, long time about the changes in the sunspots. And we've also known for 100 years or more that there was a relationship, a correlation between the number of sunspots and the temperature on the planet. And basically the way it works is that when there are very few sunspots, the Earth is colder. And when there are a lot of sunspots, the Earth is warmer. But the difficulty with that is that we knew the correlation was there. But as a scientist, you simply can't say that one is causing the other. In other words, the problem of cause and effect. Now, one of the best little stories that explains this for the average person is that you could claim, scientifically, that Diet Coke causes obesity. And your proof is that the more obese people drink Diet Coke than any other group of people. And, of course, you could then conclude that it's the Diet Cokes that's causing the obesity. Well, that's an example of a correlation that leads you to a completely false cause and effect. And so the same thing has been true of the number of sunspots and the global temperature. So we didn't know the mechanism. And the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the official climate science body, have argued all along and continue to argue that because we don't know the mechanism, we cannot include that in our studies. And so the sunspot temperature relationship is simply not studied by them. Now, there's another reason that they don't study it, and that is because they have defined climate change as only those changes caused by humans. And, of course, that then eliminates the Milankovitch effect and eliminates the sunspot causation from what they're going to look at. But, of course, as I point out to people, that you can't possibly determine how much effect humans are having if you don't know how much things are changing naturally and what are causing those changes. Now, scientists have grappled with this problem. What's the relationship? What's the mechanism? And in about 1991, and there's that period of time again, 1989, 1990, 1991, when climate science was really starting to kick in the scientific community, triggered, ironically, by the way, not by warming, but by cooling. Because from 1940 to 1985, the global temperature had been going down, and the governments were getting concerned about global cooling. That was the main trigger. But in 1991, two scientists by the name of Christiansen and Larsen produced a paper showing that the length of time between the peak sunspots and the cycles of the sunspots are every 11 years there's a peak, and every 22 years there's another cycle, but the 22-year cycle is related to a change of polarity of the sunspots, magnetic polarity. And then there are longer cycles of 150 years and up to 1,200 years and so on. But the frequency of these cycles, the length of time from one cycle to the next, they showed varied as the temperature varied. So the longer it took to go from one cycle into the next, then the lower the number of sunspots in the next cycle, and therefore the colder the temperature. That was the relationship that they drew. Now, it got, it was in the literature, but really didn't get picked up on. I remember getting very excited about it and talking it to my graduate class, but it really didn't go anywhere until about 2000, when Henrik Stensmark picked up on the theory with the two first discoverers of this, and produced what has now become known as the cosmic theory, which is beautifully described in the book that Svensmark wrote with Nigel Calder called The Chilling Stars. And they provided a mechanism that is turning out to be pretty conclusive. And that is this, that the Earth is bombarded with cosmic radiation from deep space. And the amount of cosmic radiation that reaches the Earth is controlled by the strength of the magnetic field of the Sun, and then also the Earth's magnetic field to some extent, but primarily the Sun. So the strength of the Sun's magnetic field acts like a filter, determining the amount of cosmic radiation that's going to reach the Earth's atmosphere. And as that cosmic radiation reaches the Earth's atmosphere, it penetrates down to the lower atmosphere, where it becomes a nuclei, that is a little nucleus, around which water droplets can form. Now, water droplets are water vapor, that is, water as a gas, that's condensed onto this particle. And people, you can see water droplets, even though they're microscopic, because you get billions and billions of them together, they form a cloud. That's what a cloud is made up of, are these water droplets. So if you've got more of these nuclei in the form of this cosmic rays reaching the Earth, then you're going to get more or less cloud cover as they vary. And the plots, and there's some very good ones in the book, Chilling Stars, but they're also available on the web, showing variation in cosmic radiation and the variation in low cloud. And the relationship is almost 100%. Now, people are familiar with some of these ideas because, for one thing, we've known for a long time that a lot more cloud could form than does. And we couldn't understand why more cloud wasn't forming. And we concluded it was because there weren't enough of these nuclei. And we call them condensation nuclei because the water condensates around them. And the two that we did know about that existed were salt particles from the ocean and kaolinite, which is the smallest particles of clay that get blown up into the atmosphere. Now, the other way that people are familiar with this idea is that we've experimented with for 40 years or more with cloud seeding. That means you dropping little particles, usually silver iodide, because that attracts water, into the cloud. That causes more condensation to occur, therefore more water droplets to form, and therefore can create rain, theoretically. So what we've now discovered through Svensmark's idea is another major source of these nuclei that create low cloud in the atmosphere. And of course, as I said, this if you think about that low cloud, what it's doing is it's acting as if you were putting a screen in the greenhouse. The way to cool the greenhouse down or to let it warm up is simply to block the sunlight coming through the glass. And they do that through with screening. And so the cloud then is acting like a screen in a greenhouse. And that's what's controlling the temperature and its relationship to the sun. The sunspots are therefore not directly causing the temperature change, but they are a manifestation of changes in the sun's magnetic field. And so that's the connection. So we can see, look at the sun, we can count the sunspots. And now we know that that means that the sun's magnetic field is changing, and therefore that's going to change the cloud cover, and that's going to change the temperature. Now, as I said, that's been in the scientific literature since 2000, but is not included in the IPCC reports. And so what's happening now? Where are we now with sunspots? Well, the sun reached a peak of activity in sunspots. We reached a minimum around 1700 AD. It's called the Maunder minimum, after the scientist that discovered it. There was about a 70-year span when there were virtually no sunspots. And that 70-year span, interestingly, happened to cover the life of one of the great astronomers of all time, Sir Edmund Halley, after whom the Halley Comet was named. And in his late life, in his 70s, the sunspots started to reappear. And of course, one of the manifestations of sunspots is Aurora Borealis, and they hadn't been seen for 70 years, even though they were known about. And Halley had read about sunspots, never seen them, and the Royal Society commissioned him to travel up to Scotland to see the aurora and to see and to investigate the sunspots. And he starts the article by saying, "I give thanks to God for allowing me to live long enough to witness these great phenomena." Now, that period of no sunspots came into a sort of general attention in a Scientific American article back in 1976, I believe it was, by John Eddy. And John Eddy titled the article, after the TV detective Raymond Burr played, and he called it "The Case of the Missing Sunspots." That was 1976. And of course, what Eddie pointed out was that this period of 70-year period of virtually no sunspots coincided with the Little Ice Age, this very cold period that triggered the fur trade, a demand for furs, triggered a meter of ice on the Thames River in 1683, and caused havoc with economies and agriculture throughout the world. And of course, generally, the world's been warming up since that peak. And by the way, just to give your listeners an interesting impact of this, of course, as the world cooled down in the Little Ice Age, the pack ice expanded and actually reached down to just off the coast of Scotland. Ice formed around the north coast of Ireland, sea ice, Ireland, I should say, sea ice. And there are several reports, four that I'm familiar with, of Eskimos, as they were then known, in their kayaks, showing up on the coast of Scotland. One of them even made it around into Aberdeen on the east side of Scotland. And the reports, it's very clear, there's no question what these people are reporting. And of course, the reason for it is that the pack ice has pushed way down, completely engulfed Iceland. And the Eskimos traditionally hunted for seal along the edge of the pack ice. So it was a very easy route for them to skip across the North Atlantic. So it gives you an idea of the impact of the relationship between sunspots and global temperature. Now, the sunspot numbers, as I said, had reached a minimum in the 1700s and then started to increase in number. There was still the 11-year cycle going on up and down, but the number of sunspots in each of the 11-year cycles was increasing. And then there was another minimum that began around 1790, lasted till about 1820, but it wasn't as low a number as in the Little Ice Age or Maunder Minimum, and it became known as the Dalton Minimum. And of course, that was another very cold spell, and you can relate that to the impact. For example, Charles Dickens writing about cold, snowy winters, harvest failures, and so on. And then, of course, since then, the sunspot numbers have been gradually increasing, reached a peak around 2000 AD, but have been declining since. And the number of sunspots, we started counting the 11-year cycle. 1748 was considered cycle one. We're now in cycle 23, going into 24, and it is predicted that cycle 24 will be very low in numbers, and of course it's that decline in sunspot numbers that has been triggering the cooling on the Earth that's been going on since the year 2000. And NASA, there is sunspot experts, a guy by the name of Hathaway. He just came out with another paper revising his estimate that the number of sunspots will be lower than even they thought, but doesn't surprise a lot of the rest of us. The longer the current cycle takes to build up, the lower the numbers will be. And it's generally expected that there's going to be low sunspot numbers at least till 2035. And therefore, the cooling trend that we're now in will continue till 2035. And at current conditions, it will equal the cooling that occurred with the Dalton minimum around 1800. But some people think that it could continue on to the Little Ice Age minimums of the Maunder minimum around 1700. Now, so this mechanism and major driving force of climate change, as I said, is simply not included in the IPCC reports or studies, yet it's been in the literature since 1991, and it's been very well explored and explained since 2000. So there's really no excuse for not including that in their studies.
Indeed. Well, as you point out, we've only been observing the sunspots very closely for a few hundred years, which really, of course, in the big scheme of things, isn't very long at all. And as you pointed out there, it seems that our ability to predict sunspot cycles and the intensity of or the number of sunspots that we can expect to see in each cycle is not exactly an exact science at this point. So to what extent do you put faith in the predictions about the next cycle, and to what extent should we be using caution?
Well, I put a lot of faith in it. If you remember, I mentioned earlier about the radiocarbon dating that tripped up the original Milankovitch arguments. Well, it was because, and the textbooks, by the way, still show this, they talk about the solar constant. Well, the sun's output is anything but constant. And we can recreate sunspot numbers going back in time because we can determine from the carbon-12, carbon-14 that is trapped into living organisms. We can take that back thousands of years. So to reconstruct the past sunspot cycle is not that difficult. And as I said, the actual human observation of it begins with Galileo, but you notice that we don't consider the early record that reliable, although it's being confirmed by these other sources. So we basically work from the Wolf number from 1748, but even that is far longer than any of the instrumental records that the governments have, most of which are less than 50 years or 75 years in length. So I would take the sunspot cycle numbers and record over any of the government records. And as I said, the correlation that Sven's mark has identified, I think, is very solid. Now, again, there's this ideological split, because the Russians they're the ones that are doing. Yuzhoskin is one of them. There are a couple of other names, Abramatov. These people are the ones that are in the frontiers of this sunspot climate cycle, and I have a great deal of faith in their work. It's interesting, by the way, during the Cold War, the Americans simply banned any Russian science. What saved the day was a lot of the science in Russia was being done by the Jewish scientists in Russia. And when they got out of the Soviet Union into Israel once it formed, they set up a translation service where they translated all of the Russian science into English. And then that way it became available to the world. Unfortunately, the Americans chose to, you know, because of the whole communist and the Red Scare and all the rest of it, we're not looking at it. And so there's some fascinating side stories to all of this. But no, I think that the trend with the sunspots is a pretty good scientific information.
Right. Well, excuse me, it wasn't my intention to question the correlation. It was just wondering about the prediction of the number of sunspots and how accurate that was.
Yes. Well, the actual number it is more difficult to say. Well, there'll be 78 sunspots precisely. No, we're not that good with it, but significantly lower numbers are possible. I would guess that you could predict it within, say, 10, 12 sunspot numbers, something in that order, and that's pretty good.
It certainly is. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, because obviously you are a bit under the weather and your voice is getting a bit hoarse, and also it's past midnight here in Japan now. So I'd like to start drawing this conversation to a close, but at least perhaps you could wrap up by talking, summarizing some of the points and what you think is important for people to take away on this, thinking about the impact of the sun on our climate.
Yeah, well, of course, it's ironic that a climatologist should be under the weather, but that's the way it goes, I guess. But to summarize, there is one aspect of the sun, the solar energy, that is looked at by the IPCC, and it's called the electromagnetic radiation. Now, the sun puts, because it's a nuclear reactor, puts out all sorts of energies and forms. From heat and light to particles in the form of the solar wind. And of course, some of the radiation is harmful, like any nuclear reactor, and we're protected by the Earth's magnetic field. But the electromagnetic, that is the heat and light, it has been measured, but the measurements are relatively short in length. One of the longest early ones was taken by Skylab with a 14-year record, and it doesn't show much variation. It shows the general evidence is that there's about a 0.14% change. And of course, the IPCC plugged that into their computer models, and what they concluded was that it explained over 50% of the temperature change up until about 1950. So here's this very minor part of the sun's energy effect on temperature. They're acknowledging that it explained over 50% up until 1950. Then they're telling us that from 1950 to the present, CO2 from humans explains 90% of the temperature variation. That's so bizarre that one doesn't even know where to begin talking about it. But here's the difficulty with that. You see, you say a 0.14% change. Well, that sounds minuscule. But if I tell you that you can account for, in com- computer models, you can account for all temperature change on the surface of the Earth in its 5 billion year history simply by varying that solar or electromagnetic radiation by 6%, you suddenly start to realize that a 0.14% variation is significant. And that, the energy is relatively constant, but the small amount of variability, because of the amount that gets to the Earth, just a very minor change is significant. But, of course, the reason I think that IPCC looked at that part was because they wanted to be able to say, no, it's not the sun. And therefore, they could ignore the Milankovitch effect that we've talked about, and they could ignore the changing solar magnetic field and sunspots that we've been talking about. And that way they could say, answer the question, no, it's not, to those that said it was the sun, they could say, no, it isn't the sun, and here's our proof. So that's where we are right now. And, of course, as more and more people become aware of these solar changes, and it's almost at the point now where it was that guy that worked for Carville, James Carville, when he said it's the economy, stupid. Well, there's articles out there now saying it's the sun, stupid. And of course, what's happening is the IPCC are resisting anything that dares to show or claim that the sun is the major cause of the change. And to ignore that is simply not to do even minimal science. But that's where we're at. And of course, as I said at the beginning of the talk here, the thing, despite all of the scientific arguments that people like myself and Richard Lindzen and Roy Spencer and others have put forward, that has had some small influence, but not for the majority of the people and not for the politicians, because they don't understand the science. But two or three bad winters, two or three bad summers, as the UK and Europe have had, that has done more to change and turn the tide, as we began this program with that idea, to turn things around. And of course, what they're now trying as a backstop argument, they're trying to say that, oh, well, you know, the weather's become more variable. Look at the increase in the storminess and so on. Well, the reason that it's become more variable is also very simply explained. The dome of cold air that sits over the polar regions has a boundary between it and the warm air called the polar front. Along that polar front is where the jet stream blows. The jet stream moves in waves called Rossby waves. So there are waves in that polar front. Those waves go from very low amplitude waves to very deep amplitude waves as the Earth cools down. So as the cold air expands, it pushes much further south in some areas. But that means then that warm air is going much further north in some areas. This explains not only the increased storminess, because the temperature contrast across the front is greater, but also the apparent oddity of being very warm at sometimes and very cold at others. But overall, the world is cooling down. And but of course, they're trying to deflect away from that trend and pointing at all of these things and saying, well, you know, and that leads to this incredible argument that the cold is due to warming. No, the cold is due to cooling. And if you understand even the simplest mechanisms, you can see why and why they're wrong.
Indeed. Well, is it that big, giant ball of fire that bathes us in radiation every day in the sky that's responsible for the climate? No, that sounds like a ridiculous conspiracy theory. No, obviously, I think it is something that more and more people are paying attention to now, and thankfully so, whether that's because we've had some bad winters or whether that's because people are looking into the science. At any rate, people are starting to question what they're being told by the people in positions of power to try to spread the myth that it really is all about human-made CO2. So thankfully, we have people like yourself who are continuing to spread the message and being a tireless voice of reason amidst the chatter of noise and unreason out there. So, Dr. Timball, thank you once again for all of this information and for talking yourself hoarse today, quite literally. But before we go, are there any sources you'd like to direct people to on these topics specifically?
Well, I mentioned the book, The Chilling Stars, by Svensmark and Calder. Calder, of course, is a science journalist who's written a lot of the books about the sun. He did another one called The Manic Sun. It's more difficult to get a hold of, and it's more of a coffee table type of book. But it is where the whole Svensmark idea begins. And, of course, we've got a book out, a group of us, called Slaying the Sky Dragon, and subtitled The Death of the Greenhouse Theory. And that's available on ebooks or at Amazon.com. The readers will find some of the chapters a bit difficult to follow, but I think they'll get enough out of it to understand how much the science has been corrupted. So those are two books that I would mention, or three actually, yeah.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Ball, I hope this is the first of many conversations between us in the future about specific aspects of the science of climate science. What would you like to talk about next?
Well, I think that there are so many aspects of it that we need to talk about the sun. One of the ones that I would love to talk about, because it's triggering another of these sort of environmental hysterias, and that is the comment I made about them focusing on temperature when the world is cooling, and the politicians are preparing us for cooling, and what implications are there to that. And then the other one, of course, is they're saying that with the warming, there's going to be more droughts. Well, that's counterintuitive, because if the world warms up, you get more evaporation and more moisture in the atmosphere, and therefore more rainfall, not less. And what that is bringing focus on is water. And, of course, I've long taught courses in water resources, and I've had a campaign going to change the name of the planet from Earth to water, and the implications of that as the next environmental boondoggle could give us many conversations and help people understand, and therefore not be panicked and realize what games are being played.
Absolutely. Well, definitely some food for thought, and I'm looking forward to our future conversations. So hopefully once you've recovered from your current bug, we can continue the conversation and continue spreading awareness of the real aspects of climate science, and not the climate science that's being perpetrated by the UN. So, Dr. Ball, thank you again for all your time today.
Thank you, James, and thank you for what you do. Really appreciate the opportunity.